Knowledge Products presents Karl Marx, Das Kapital, Part 1.
In 1852, a secret agent for the government of Prussia, the leading German state, visited the dangerous German revolutionary communist, Dr. Karl Marx, then living in squalor in London, England. Reporting back to his employers, the agent described Dr. Marx's living conditions.
As father and husband, Marx, in spite of his wild and restless character, is the gentlest and mildest of men. Marx lives in one of the worst, therefore one of the cheapest quarters of London. He occupies two rooms. The one looking out on the street is the salon, and the bedroom is at the back. In the whole apartment, there is not one clean and solid piece of furniture. Everything is broken, tattered, and torn with a half inch of dust over everything and the greatest disorder everywhere. In the middle of the salon, there is a large old-fashioned table covered with an oilcloth, and on it there lie manuscripts, books, and newspapers, as well as the children's toys, the rags and tatters of his wife's sewing basket, several cups with broken rims, knives, forks, lamps, an inkpot, tumblers, Dutch clay, pipes, tobacco ash. In a word, everything topsy-turvy, and all on the same table. A seller of second-hand goods would be ashamed to give away such a remarkable collection of odds and ends. When you enter Marx's room, smoke and tobacco fumes make your eyes water so much that for a moment you seem to be groping about in a cavern. But gradually, as you grow accustomed to the fog, you can make out certain objects which distinguish themselves from the surrounding haze. Everything is dirty and covered with dust, so that to sit down becomes a thoroughly dangerous business. Here is a chair with only three legs. On another chair, the children are playing at cooking. This chair happens to have four legs. This is the one which is offered to the visitor, but the children's cooking has not been wiped away, and if you sit down, you risk a pair of trousers.
Marx was unemployed, impoverished, obscure, and unrecognized. He had arrived in England in 1849, expecting his stay to be a short one, since he believed that revolution was sure to break out soon on the European continent. But the much-hoped-for revolution never came, and Marx resided in London until his death in 1883. He thought of moving with his family to the United States, but was deterred by the price of the passenger tickets. Marx was not very well known, except to a handful of dedicated revolutionaries and a handful of police spies. He spent some of his time writing revolutionary pamphlets, and some of it intriguing against rival revolutionary factions. But he spent much of his time studying and writing on economics. One of the reasons why he stayed in London was because of the library at the British Museum, the world's most complete collection of works on economics. Spending day after day in the British Museum, Marx became by far the most knowledgeable person of his day in the history of economic thought. But for Marx, economics was not an end in itself. He was a revolutionary first and an economist second. He tried to show by economic reasoning that capitalism was based on exploitation, that it was unstable, and that it would lead to communism. Though he wrote many short works on economic themes, Marx pinned his hopes on his great masterwork, which would give a correct analysis of capitalism, while at the same time refuting all previous economic theories of capitalism. This work was eventually called Das Kapital in the original German, which is translated into English simply as Capital. The first volume appeared in 1867. Marx anticipated that it would make him famous and perhaps rich. For many years he had battled against illness and despondency to produce this, the first of four enormous volumes. But volume one of Capital had a disappointing reception. It was considered too difficult and abstract. It sold only 1,000 copies in the first 4 years. Marx commented that his royalties did not pay for the cigars he smoked while writing it. Most of the reviews which appeared either were planted by Marx's friends or completely missed the point. One review warmly praised the book as a useful guide for capitalists in running their factories. One development which Marx did not expect was that the book was soon translated into Russian and began to attract real interest in Russia before it did so in any other country. Marx hated Russia and considered it backward, barbaric, and the greatest enemy of progress. The Russian government censorship committee permitted Capital to be distributed with the following comment.
The work is difficult and hardly comprehensible. Few will read it, and still fewer understand it. Although the political convictions of the author are completely socialist, and although the whole book is very definitely socialist in character, the book's style of presentation is not such as to make it open to all. And furthermore, it is written in a strictly scientific fashion. So, the committee declares this book to be immune from prosecution.
But the Russian edition sold better than any other, and copies were passed eagerly from hand to hand among the young Russian radicals, sometimes disguised between the covers of a New Testament. Despite this, Marx's Capital did not begin to become really well known anywhere until 20 years later. Today, over 100 years after its first publication, Capital has sold more copies than any other economics book in history. It has become the most revered scripture of the communist parties which rule almost half the world. And in every part of the world, radical dissidents devour it eagerly. Millions of people who have barely heard of Marx or Capital accept many of its arguments, notably the idea that profit comes from exploiting workers by paying them less than they produce, that competition automatically destroys itself by creating monopoly, and that just as a single firm is centrally directed, so the whole economy might one day be centrally directed. All these ideas existed before Marx, but it was Marx's writings, especially Capital, which led to the popular perception that these ideas had been scientifically demonstrated. Marx was born in 1818 in the town of Trier, in that region of Germany which had recently been part of Napoleon's empire. In his youth, Marx was a radical liberal democrat, and this got him into trouble with the police. He had become a communist by 1844 when he was 26. His ideas continued to evolve, but by 1847, when he co-authored the famous Communist Manifesto, many of Marx's characteristic ideas were set for the rest of his life. Marx's views were largely formed by conditions in Europe in the 1840s, and to the end of his life, his thinking reflected these conditions, despite the spectacular changes which took place in Europe from the 50s through the 80s. Europe in the 1840s was predominantly agricultural, as it had been for centuries. The majority of people were still tied to the land as peasant farmers. Some of these peasants were leaving the land and becoming factory workers, selling their services for wages, but this was still comparatively rare. In some places, notably in Manchester in the north of England, large numbers of laborers worked for wages in giant factories. Manchester in the 1840s was, like Los Angeles in the 1960s, a picture of the future. But to most people in Europe, the idea of working for a wage in a factory was as remote as living on the moon seems today. Even in some places where there were large masses of workers, such as Paris and London, a worker usually meant an artisan, a self-employed craftsman, or someone employed in a tiny workshop. The majority of people farmed the same land their fathers had farmed and acknowledged the same lord, the local aristocratic landowner. Hardly anywhere in the world was there a government which could be called democratic in the modern sense, and it did not seem likely that anything approaching democracy could possibly arrive in most European countries within a lifetime. In total population, the United States was only just drawing level with Britain. America was still essentially an outpost of Europe. Yet to those who looked carefully at European conditions, it was clear that the new industrial working class while still small, was steadily growing and might eventually become the majority of the population. These new workers, sometimes called the proletariat, were unlike any earlier class of people. They lived mainly in towns and had no connection with the land. They changed jobs frequently, moving from one employer to another, from one region to another, and even from one occupation to another. They had no permanent stake in their jobs or communities, and they did not own any part of the equipment they used at work. They were sometimes employed to operate gigantic, noisy, frightening machines, the like of which the world had never seen. Yet the workers had no say in how these machines were used. Socially and politically, members of the proletariat were outcasts. They had no political representation or recognition. Although expanding rapidly, they were still fewer in number than the large population of domestic servants who catered to the wants of the well-to-do. Factory workers were considered servants under the authority of masters, but without the dignity or security of a maid, a butler, or a groom. They were often despised by the landowners and by their capitalist employers. They were often treated as insolently by the police as they were treated at work by the overseers. They worked from 12 to 18 hours a day, from infancy. Their work often injured them physically, and when they were too old or diseased to find employment, they sometimes faced complete destitution and further indignities at the hands of the authorities. Their food was adulterated, and their dwellings lacked what we would consider the most basic essentials of sanitation and comfort. They slept in their clothes, and many of them had never seen soap. They often drank large quantities of alcohol and fed their babies patent medicines containing opium to keep them quiet. Frequently, whole working-class communities were decimated by plagues of cholera, typhoid, or scarlet fever, while deaths from consumption were commonplace. The chances of a worker's children being able to go to college were zero, and their chances of being able to move up in society by any means were close to zero. In 1845, Marx's close friend Frederick Engels published his book The Condition of the Working Class in England, based partly on documentary records and partly on his own observations. It is filled with horrific descriptions, such as this one of a Manchester neighborhood.
In a rather deep hole, surrounded on all four sides by tall factories and high embankments, stand two groups of about 200 cottages, built chiefly back to back, in which live about 4,000 human beings, most of them Irish. The cottages are old, dirty, and of the smallest sort. The streets uneven, fallen into ruts, and in part without drains or pavement. Masses of refuse, offal, and sickening filth lie among standing pools in all directions. The atmosphere is poisoned by the effluvia from these and darkened by the smoke of a dozen tall factory chimneys. A horde of ragged women and children swarm about here, as filthy as the swine that thrive upon the garbage heaps and in the puddle. The race that lives in these ruinous cottages, behind broken windows, mended with oilskin, sprung doors and rotten doorposts, or in dark, wet cellars in measureless filth and stench, this race must really have reached the lowest stage of humanity. But what must one think when he hears that in each of these pens, containing at most two rooms, a garret and perhaps a cellar, on the average 20 human beings live, that in the whole region, for each 120 persons, one usually inaccessible privy is provided.
There were variations in the condition of the workers. Some groups of workers were better off than others, but there were highly visible cases where rapid technical progress destroyed the superior position of some groups of craftsmen. The position of the better-off workers seemed highly precarious. 150 years later, most observers would conclude that the growth of this new working class was part of an improvement in industrial productivity which would eventually benefit everyone. At the time, this was far from obvious. Statistical research was in its infancy. Whether there was any improvement in the condition of the workers was open to question. For example, it was still seriously debated whether machinery brought any benefit at all to the ordinary worker. The famous economist David Ricardo had changed his mind on this question, deciding that machinery might very well bring no benefit whatever and might even hurt the working class. Marx later praised Ricardo for his honesty in this matter. The even more famous liberal writer, John Stuart Mill, wrote in 1848,
"It is questionable if all the mechanical inventions yet made have lightened the day's toil of any human being."
The orthodox, respectable opinion of the day was the population principle of T. Robert Malthus. Malthus argued that any substantial improvement in the lot of the mass of the people was impossible, because increases in population would always tend to outrun food supply. The socialists and communists argued that a revolution was necessary in order to improve the living conditions of the masses. Respectable people most often did not argue that there were better ways to improve the conditions of the masses. Under the influence of Malthus, they argued that any substantial improvement in conditions was impossible, and therefore socialism was impossible. Although the Industrial Revolution was advancing across Europe and beginning to make itself felt in Germany, Germany lagged behind other countries, especially Britain, but also France. Germany in Europe at that time was something like the third world is in the world today. Some German intellectuals had an inferiority complex about German backwardness, both economic and political. The fact that Germans had made contributions in music and philosophy only made these intellectuals more impatient. They feared that Germany was good only for theorizing and that it was retarded in all practical matters. German free market liberals expected that Germany would eventually copy England and adopt a free market economic policy along with political tolerance. They thought they only had to wait for liberal reforms to arrive and did not dream that German liberalism, instead of going from strength to strength, was about to disappear completely for 100 years. When socialist ideas arrived in Germany, they were persecuted. But at the same time, the German authorities quietly encouraged some socialist activities. This was done to weaken the liberal opposition, which was pressing for civil rights and less government interference. Young German middle-class intellectuals looked above all to France. The ideals of the French Revolution of 1789 inspired them, and even the German experience of French occupation under Napoleon's troops introduced them to a more tolerant form of government. After the fall of Napoleon, Paris was continually threatened by revolutionary disturbances. Paris was a center for political debate, although this was illegal under the monarchy. Secret political clubs operated, mainly for discussion, but occasionally for street fighting. Since political agitation could only be secret, some of these clubs made a virtue of conspiratorial methods. The secret societies believed that the French Revolution had failed, and they wanted to pursue its ideals, liberty, equality, and brotherhood, by more radical methods. In 1830, one of the revolutionary uprisings succeeded in toppling the government of King Charles X, who was seen as acting in the interests of the aristocracy and the church. This revolution involved 3 days of violent battles on the streets of Paris, carried out mainly by urban workers and middle-class intellectuals. Although the new king, Louis Philippe, introduced some liberal reforms, he was seen by the radicals as ruling much like the old king, but with an important exception. Instead of being under the thumb of the aristocracy and church, he was under the thumb of bankers and industrialists. This made the secret societies even more radical. They decided that a more thorough revolution was necessary. Not just a change of political regime, but a complete transformation of the way people lived and worked. It was in Paris in the 1830s that the words le socialisme, socialism, and le communisme, communism, first came into use. Socialist ideas varied greatly, but most socialists wanted more central direction of industry. Not all socialists were hostile to the market or to private property. Communists were more extreme. They generally wanted to abolish both private property and money. One of the most influential of the secret societies, called the Society of the Seasons, was led by the celebrated revolutionary Louis-Auguste Blanqui. This society did not yet employ the words socialist or communist, but was as hostile to the aristocracy of money as to the aristocracy of birth. The society had a solemn ceremony for the initiation of a new member, in which the new member was blindfolded throughout. The new member was brought before the president and members and reminded that traitors would be put to death. After the president had asked a few personal questions, the ceremony proceeded.
What do you think of royalty and kings?
That they are as dangerous to mankind as a tiger is to other animals.
Who are the aristocrats now?
The aristocracy of birth was abolished in July 1830. It was replaced by the aristocracy of money, which is as voracious as the former.
Must we be content with overthrowing the monarchy?
All aristocrats must be overthrown. All privileges must be abolished.
What should we put in its place?
The government of the people themselves, that is the republic.
Are those who have rights without duties, as is true of the aristocrats, part of the people?
They should never be made apart. They are to the social body what a cancer is to the human body. The first condition of the social body's return to justice is the annihilation of aristocracy.
Will the people be able to govern themselves immediately after the revolution?
The social state being gangrenous, heroic remedies are needed to return to a state of health. For a period of time, the people will need a revolutionary power.
In short, what then are your principles?
We must exterminate the monarchy and all aristocrats and replace them with a republic, that is, a government of equality. But in order to bring about this government, we must employ a revolutionary power to ensure that the people exercise their rights.
Our enemies are numerous and powerful. They have all the forces of society at their disposal, while we Republicans even have our name outlawed. Are you resolved to risk a sacrifice of fortune, the loss of liberty, and perhaps even death?
Yes.
Your reply is a proof of your strength. Arise, citizen, and swear the following oath. In the name of the Republic?
In the name of the Republic?
I swear eternal hatred.
I swear eternal hatred.
To all kings.
To all kings.
All aristocrats.
All aristocrats.
And all oppressors of humanity.
And all oppressors of humanity.
I promise to give my life.
I promise to give my life.
If this sacrifice is necessary.
If this sacrifice is necessary.
To bring the reign of equality.
To bring the reign of equality.
And the sovereignty of the people.
And the sovereignty of the people.
This is the end of part one. Please download part two to continue.